Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia?
Sorry to burn too many things we found. We're back again with the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show here at PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Got a very good show for you today. Two great, great activists. Mimi Kennedy here in Los Angeles. Mimi, you on with us?
Yeah, I am, Harvey.
Hi there. How are you? Great to have you. I'm honored. And Diana Cohen, are you on with us yet?
I am. I'm here. Hi, Harvey. Hi, Mimi.
Hi, Diana. How are you? Diana. Great, great, great. Well,
good. It's great to be here.
We're honored to have you both, two of the great activists that I know. It's an amazing honor, and we're going to cover a lot of stuff. We're going to start with Mimi, and we're going to talk to Diana for the bulk of the hour about plastics and plastics pollution. She is a very long-time activist on this situation and has done astounding work. I just watched her. You're absolutely terrific. And founder of the of many organizations that we'll talk about in terms of this incredible plague of terrible plastic disasters. I do want to start first with Mimi Kennedy. Mimi is about as fierce an Irish activist as I've ever met. Diane, I don't think you're Irish, but Mimi is. And you have been dealing, Mimi, with the problem of election theft and the solutions, which are coming closer and closer as we speak, I think. And really, we're making tremendous progress on the issue of election theft, even getting down to a situation where we have a combination of computer voting and hand-counted paper ballots that seems to make sense. So can we get into this? Mimi, tell us the latest developments in election protection and fighting election theft.
Well, the thing I'm really excited about, Harvey, is that we may have for 2018 a chance to publicly audit the paper ballot elections. Now, that certainly won't cover all of the United States, but I've learned that in this whack-a-mole job of trying to get election officials to have honest elections that are transparently verifiable instead of just telling us what the computer said, we need to make the offices accountable one by one almost, and then the shiver, the frisson of fear goes out across the land into other election offices as, oh gosh, they're going to make us accountable. And I think that alone is a deterrent that clears things up. And what we found, John Brakey specifically of Arizona found in a court case he began pursuing in Pima County and Maricopa County, was that some of the scanners of paper ballots, specifically from ES&S, are digital, and they take a little JPEG of each ballot as it goes through the scanner. So they're counting all the votes on those paper ballots, but they're also taking a picture of the paper ballot. And those pictures are stored. And if anybody gets their hands on those pictures, they can add up the votes on those pictures and see for themselves who won in any particular race in a particular precinct or county. So this is amazing. And it only happens where there's paper ballots. But where there are paper ballots, every time we've gone in for a recount or even an audit of a smelly election, we find election officials going, can't get your hands on those paper ballots. No, those are very delicate election records. You have to go to court. You have to get $15,000, $30,000 for a lawyer. And we won't let you see them anyway. But with these digital images, they're basically data generated by the election and in federal and state law that says that's an election record. And for most records like that, that are not paper ballots, that don't have a chain of custody issue, you can apply for those as a public record. And then you can look at the election yourself. This is an amazing thing. And in three states, Alabama, Ohio, and, well, Arizona and New York, four states really, John has, or another lawyer, filed to see, to preserve the ballots instead of destroy them, which they've been doing in Ohio, no surprise there. And after they're preserved, to allow the public access via public records request. And that is now the law in New York State. Where it's almost the law in Alabama to preserve them. And I'll let you ask questions now. And in Ohio, they filed, Bob Petrakis, your comrade and mine, although forgive the noun if people jump at it. But, you know, your colleague and mine in this effort filed in Ohio to preserve the ballot images that were being destroyed. Once they're preserved, as I say, then we go for access. And New York State has set a lovely precedent under federal and state law.
So, Mimi Kennedy, how widespread is this technology? Basically, you're saying we now have technology which you go to the polling station, you fill out a paper ballot, you slip the paper ballot into the computer. The computer reads the paper ballot and creates an image, a visual image of the ballot. And so you then have the actual ballot and you have the visual image of the ballot. The computer can instantly, and computer the way computers do, count the ballots based on the visual images, but you also have the paper backup. Sounds like how widespread is this technology? How many states will be using this technology in 2018?
It's approximately 15, I think. I went to Audit Arizona's website. It varies by county, Harvey. We're still in a muddy area where each county in a state can have different things that they do with their ballots and their voting system. But there's a fairly extensive list. For instance, in Texas, one county has digital scanners for their paper ballots. I know elsewhere in Texas there are still DREs with no paper whatsoever.
A DRE is a direct recorded entry, which is a touch screen machine, which we call push and pray voting, where you hit something and you never see it again and you never know how it's counted.
And you don't have a paper trail of any kind and you don't have a ballot image. Right. I mean, those should just be outlawed, but they haven't been banned yet because of monetary. Everybody's so strapped. Counties are strapped. They have nothing for schools, nothing for children, social services, you know. So it's been hard to say, hey, cough up $2 million for a new voting system. But the more accountability that we can get into some of these big states and counties like Ohio to say, look, we're going to have ballot images. We can audit the election now. We, the public, don't have to beg you to recount by running them through the scanners, which can be rigged again. We're going to file for those ballot images and we're going to look at them ourselves. And each ballot image, by the way, has a number on it, the way you would have a flight locator number on your itinerary for your tickets. It's unique. It identifies that ballot, but not you, the voter, and it also identifies the ballot image. So if you were going to hack a ballot image verifiable election, you would have to substitute fake ballot images, and then you'd have to know exactly which ballots you faked in the image and get your hands on the paper ballots and then substitute made out fake ballots for that too, so that they would match if anybody went looking. So it
right. And those of us who have been advocating hand count of paper ballots, we do run into a problem. And you, Mimi, took me to a precinct in Los Angeles. And the challenge in Los Angeles with straight hand count of paper ballots, as in much of the country, is that we are thankfully a greatly diverse country. And so in L.A. alone, there are 14 different languages you can vote in. And so the computer does allow the production on the spot of a ballot in the language that you're going to vote in, so we avoid that problem. Diana Cohen, do you want to jump in on this one as a fellow Angeleno? All three of us, actually.
As a fellow Angeleno, I think it's the most important thing I can say is we all need to vote. And I actually really appreciate paper ballots. That's me.
Yes. Well, so what this does, and forgive me if I'm mischaracterizing Mimi, you produce the paper ballot on the spot because you are dealing with a computer. Then you hand fill in the paper ballot. Then you insert the paper ballot into the machine. The machine reads it, and then it comes out the other side, and so you still have the actual paper ballot that you filled out. That's the process.
Yeah,
right?
It's not quite like that in Los Angeles because our ballots are so long. So you're going to vote, and your paper ballot will produce a list of your selections. And if you voted for Harvey Wasserman and it comes out without the name Harvey Wasserman on it, you destroy that paper ballot, go to the poll worker and start over. That ballot is never counted. It's just produced and you spoil it because it's not what you wanted. You have to look at that paper ballot before you cast it. When you cast it, it goes into a locked box at the back of this ballot maker. And the locked boxes are taken, as now, to a central tabulator in Norwalk. We don't count at the precinct. One reason for that is I think there was a formerly lot of fraud going on at various precincts. So, you know, how many years ago, 25, 30, the safe thing to do was to lock the ballots in a locked ballot box, have two people drive it to the central drop-off center, and there you have teams of people and sheriffs and everybody else, and they're driven in trucks with sheriffs down to Norwalk. So we don't count at the precinct, and we're going to be opening voting centers, which will be, I'm all for it. Once we have this technology, you can vote anywhere, near your job, near your school, near your grandmother's house, because when you sign in, your address creates the kind of paper ballot that you would have gotten if you went to your precinct. Now, unless you go to your precinct on election day, you have to vote provisionally because you're not in the right precinct and you can only vote for some of the races on the precinct ballot where you ended up. With voting centers, you can vote, you can get the ballot that you belong to and vote it on this thing and it goes in a lockbox. They're all counted centrally, and that's where the central tabulator takes a picture of everything. But the ballot marking device we will have in LA will also, as far as I know, I just talked to the registrar yesterday, and some of this is still being worked out, where the ballot image will be identified and stamped. But the ballot marking device, I think, is capable of creating an image, but if you spoil the ballot, then you have to spoil that image as well. So I'm not sure. I know for sure when it comes to the central tabulator, those paper ballots will be scanned and a picture will be taken of each. That's, I think,
okay.
What we get. Yeah.
Well, let's hope we get to that point. What I consider the most important election in American history coming up, 2018, because if we don't somehow get control of the Congress, we don't have to go into the realities of Donald Trump. We also have, I'm going to have you back, Mimi, another time, because we're also going to talk about gerrymandering. There's some important lawsuits going on about gerrymandering. And then, you know, we somehow have to get a democratic electoral system.
I want to leave you with one thing, Harvey. This is a solution for 2018, because if you go to court and the whole state has to save whatever ballot images they've got, that deters fraud in every place in that state that might otherwise think about it. If an operative said, we need your precinct to rig the vote, we need your county to rig the vote, and then to say it's a glitch or it goes down, those frauds are not possible once the law is you have to save the ballot image. That's why it's so important for 2018. It's a fast,
right,
quick, it's not getting teams to hand count paper ballots and all these things that would take 10 years. This is it. Court case, you win it at the Supreme Court level, as we did in New York, and you have a deterrent.
Great. Well, we're going to have you back to talk about this, Mimi, and you're welcome to stay on with Deanna Cohen as we move into plastics now. And thank you so much, Mimi, for your great work. Tell us how
you're
to get
welcome.
In touch with you.
I'm eager to hear, Diana, yeah.
How do we get in touch with you, and what's your organization?
Well, for ballot images, go to Audit Arizona. That has
Audit Arizona, and you are you're the chair of the Progressive Democrats of America. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, we don't have the ballot images stuff on our website. That's at Audit Arizona because John Brakey's doing that work. But PDA has always been part of election integrity, especially dealing with the technology and also voter suppression. We're on it.
Wonderful. All right, Mimi, you're welcome to stay with us. We're going to talk with Deanna Cohen now about plastics, but I so admire your work, and you as a person, you're just fantastic. And people, this is it. We know that the elections of 2000, 2004, and 2016 were stolen. People got into the White House who were not elected, and God knows, we all know what happened. So we can't let this go on. This is the fate of the earth in our hands here. And Deanna Cohen, you've been fighting for the fate of the earth here. With such incredible work. As I said, I just watched your TED talk on plastics. You're the founder of the Plastics Pollution Coalition. Let's tell it right up front how people can get a hold of you, and then we'll jump in and we'll give it at the end as well. How do people get a hold of you, Deanna Cohen, to fight this plastics issue that you're going to tell us so much about here?
Sure. So we are Plastic Pollution Coalition. We're a global coalition. At this point, we're made up of over 700 businesses and NGOs around the world who are all working to stop plastic pollution and to raise awareness about the toxic impact on human health, animal health, the ocean and waterways, and the environment. You can find us pretty easily. We're across social media, but our website is plasticpollutioncoalition.org, O-R-G. And we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram. We're everywhere. And our coalition has grown exponentially since we were founded in the end of 2009. I am the CEO, and I'm one of the original four co-founders of the organization. And I came to this work and learned about the issue really through my work as a visual artist. I've been making artwork for about 28 years out of plastic bags that I cut up and sew back together. And I found after the first 8 years or so of working with plastic bags as my material that several of the bags in some of the pieces I was making had started to fissure or break apart. I got really excited about that, and I thought that meant that plastic was ephemeral and organic like us, like flowers, like cats and dogs, like our bodies. And so I began to explore that and found that's not actually the case with plastic, that much of the plastic, particularly plastic that unfortunately we use for design, which is intended to be used for very short amounts of time, like for food and beverage packaging, plastic bottles, plastic bags, plastic cups, will unfortunately, due to the material, last longer than a human lifetime. We're not even actually sure how long it'll last. Some estimates are that a plastic bottle will last 400 years. So
400 years?
We have
a plastic bottle.
So we've created an amazing material. Well, we don't know, but we've created this incredible material in plastic. But at the same time, it's kind of like our Frankenstein baby. So yeah.
My God, that's mind-boggling. So tell us, we got it. A good chunk of time here. So tell us, Diana, what exactly does your organization do to fight plastic pollution?
Well, we work together with our coalition members to amplify common messages. So when we first created the coalition, what we found is that no one was using the word plastic when they were talking about what we were saying happened. And so that was the first battle that we took on, the battle to call it what it is. So I think that language and words are very important, and we can see the manipulation of language when we look at an episode or an occurrence or an event, like, for example, the BP oil disaster. That, in my personal opinion, it was not a spill. I'm familiar with having spilled things, That was certainly not a spill. That was a geyser or a gusher or, you know, a disaster and an ongoing disaster that's had long-lasting ramifications and may not even have been fully corrected at this point. So we decided it was very...
Wait. Let me stop you right there real quick. What do you mean it hasn't been fully corrected?
Well, I mean, have we completely capped that platform?
Are you saying that plastic, that there we go, that oil is still pouring out, that it's not over?
Isn't it?
I don't know. Is oil still coming out of the spill? Is it not completely capped?
I don't believe it's completely capped.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, at least with the Exxon Valdez and these other tankers, there's only so much oil in the tankers, right? I mean, it's not a great thing, but there is a finite amount of pollution that can come out of an oil tanker. But as you correctly point out, and it's an important point, when you have a gusher from an oil well, it's probably never really over. Isn't that correct?
Well, I mean, look at Fukushima. I mean, that's a disaster. And depending on what kind of information is coming out, do we know if something's been, you know, stopped or corrected? Do we know if something is still leaking from the reactors there? We don't know exactly. But so I'll go back to my point, which is language is very important. The BP oil disaster was a disaster. It was not a spill. And so at the time that we created Plastic Pollution Coalition, we decided it was important to call it what it is. We are talking about plastic, and we are talking about plastic pollution. And at the time that we created the organization, people were referring to it as marine debris. The U.S. government and NOAA refer to this stuff in the ocean as marine debris. And the definition of marine debris does not have the word plastic in it. So we decided it was important to include the word plastic. So that was the first goal that we took on. And that has been very, very effective. When we refer to plastic, and specifically when we take on single-use and disposable plastics, we are talking about how it becomes plastic pollution in the environment, in the ocean, in waterways. And so that was very important to us.
Let me say on that, I think you've been extremely effective on that. I think most people now, there is an awareness, thanks to your work, of these huge, I guess we call them gyres, of trash in the middle of the Pacific. And then I would assume there's one in the Atlantic as well and all the other oceans. And I think that most people now, thanks to your work, do understand that the vast bulk of this stuff is plastic. It's not like some neutered, as you said, marine debris. I think there is an understanding in the world now that that most of the stuff is plastic, and that it is a plastic problem. So we'll start by thanking you for that. Okay, all right, let's go ahead.
Well, I mean, I would thank the whole coalition for that, but also even and NOAA and the government recognize this, that 70 to 90% of the marine debris is plastic, and that is why we decided to call it plastic pollution. So
that
is where we began, and that was our first goal. And I think that we have achieved a lot. We have much further to go. But that was our first goal. Our second goal was to take, conceptually, to take the idea, which is taught to a lot of school children, of the three R's to reduce, reuse, and recycle, and add a fourth R onto the front of it, which is, whenever possible, to refuse single-use plastic. So when you go to a cafe, the market, a restaurant, a bar, an eatery, to look around and see what is being offered, how food is being served, and see if you can consciously direct that so that you don't end up creating a bunch of plastic pollution and plastic waste from a meal. And one of the easiest kind of gateways to start that is to when you order a drink or when you just sit down, because now recently people have been serving me water with plastic straws in them. As soon as I enter a cafe or a restaurant, I say, hi, I'd like water, I'd like an iced tea, no straw, please don't put any plastic in my drink. And we're seeing a lot of major gaining momentum around something that seems as trivial or as small as a plastic straw. And a project called The Last Plastic Straw, which was a coalition member, has now become a project of Plastic Pollution Coalition, and the founder, Jackie Nunez, is the program director. And she's had tremendous exponential growth in this movement, where she has created simple tools that allow people to go to an eatery to gently and kindly make suggestions to them that they consider changing their protocol. So stop automatically giving people plastic straws and beverages. Have straws only available upon request. And if possible and manageable, switch to a straw that actually really does break down, go back to the earth, is 100% compostable. For example, a paper straw. Or now there are a couple companies making straws that they grow out of rye wheat and wheat. Then there are reusable straws, which are stainless steel or made from glass or grown from bamboo. I mean, there are a lot of really interesting, creative options. And for me, I like straws with my iced tea, so I carry a reusable stainless steel straw. And it makes the drink really nice and cool when I drink out of it. And it's part of my urban pack kit that I travel with.
That's fantastic. I love that. So tell us about the progress she's making. Is there a straw, a commercially available straw for restaurants to substitute for the plastic that's of comparable cost? How do we stand on that?
Yes, it's not exactly comparable cost, but I would say that the cost for the plastic straws is actually underestimated, because the cost of using a plastic straw, or frankly, any single-use plastic, does not take into account the impact on human health, animal health, the ocean, and the environment. So plastic is really being sold to us at a reduced cost that does not take into account all these other impacts, which have been externalized, unfortunately. But paper straws are a little bit more. But I think if you change your protocol, which is stop automatically giving them out, at the same time that you make the switch to paper straws or to a reusable straw, which you can let customers use while they're there and or sell if people would like to purchase them, you will be creating system shift. And we are watching that happen all around us right now in a very big and exciting way, with entire food chains making a commitment. For example, in Great Britain, Wagamama, which is a noodles chain, has just made a commitment to get rid of plastic straws, which I think is very exciting.
What's the name of the company?
It's called Wagamama.
W-A-G-A-M-A-M-A?
Yes.
Cool. We like that. How about the States?
Are there places you can recommend people go? Pardon?
Are there places in the States where they've made a similar commitment you can recommend people to go?
Well, people are beginning to make that commitment. There's a whole group of aquariums and zoos that have made a commitment. They've joined together and made a commitment to phase out single-use plastics. And one of the first places that they're all starting is to get rid of plastic straws.
Beautiful. I love that. Tell us what's in your urban kit, along with your stainless steel straw there.
So my urban kit includes a to-go-ware bamboo utensil set, which has a fork, knife, and spoon, and a set of chopsticks in it. And I love that. And I actually slide two stainless steel straws in the back of it, so that when I'm out, if I'm with a friend for a meeting or an appointment, I can always offer them a straw, because I realized it was a little bit insensitive of me to go out without an extra one in case someone else needed it. So I've got two straws and my bamboo utensil set. Then I carry a reusable small steel cup, either a single-walled one, or when I'm traveling, I just came back from speaking at a conference in New Orleans at Collision yesterday, and I had brought my own double-walled steel cup. I like traveling with that, and I'll ask on airplanes, et cetera, for people to put my drink in my own cup, so I don't have to use any single-use plastic cups on the plane or at the airport. And then I generally carry a reusable canvas bag and or a small fold-up mini Chico bag with me so that I always have a bag if I need to purchase something and I don't have to take a plastic bag.
God, I love that idea. So, okay, now, it is a terrible suggestion. I'm sure other people have suggested it. Have you ever thought of, like, marketing your Urban Kit as a product so that people can do the same thing? I'm sure many, many, many people would love to do that. But don't have the wherewithal to put it together.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, Harvey. We are putting together a post right now to share with people that either would allow them to select different materials so they could put together their own new Urban Packer kit, but we also have created just guidance for a DIY kit so that you can take elements which you might already have in your possession or at home or find at a secondhand store and put a kit together without it costing you money. So, I mean, there are other friends of mine who their kit consists of carrying a fold-up metal spork from Life Without Plastic or a different group that makes those. And those are really great, too. There are also bamboo sporks or sporks that have a spoon on one side and a fork on the other side. And then my friend Jackie Nunez, who's really a great example of a person who's always carrying an Urban Pack kit, she also carries these two small titanium camping plates with her so that she's always got a to-go plate that she can carry things in. So, you know, you can add a napkin to it or you can add whatever you want to, any elements that you like. Jackie also carries a tiny little pop-up solar light that we were all together for a meeting for Plastic Free Islands in St. John in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And the power went out in the cafe that we were all sitting in. And she just instantly had it with a carabiner off the back of her backpack. She unhooked it, she popped it open, the light came on, and she just took the carabiner and suspended it up above us, and everybody had light in the bar to finish eating their meal.
Wow, that's so cool. Okay, so I'm going to give you an off-the-wall suggestion, which you can reject or whatever, but I'm going to suggest that maybe you get some entrepreneurial ties and put together an Urban Pack and sell it online, and I will be the first. I will be the first customer. Because if you had, you know, people are people, if somebody could just buy this really cool, Plastics Pollution Coalition pack with, you know, made of hemp, a bag with all that stuff in it, I bet you'd do great. And I bet you could really help fund a lot of stuff. But, you know, that's just me. That's just my suggestion.
Well, I love your suggestion, Harvey, and we've already taken that to heart. So through our website, you can find basically all the kindling for a kit like that. We haven't marketed it that way because it's not really the business we're in. We're a nonprofit, but I think it's a great idea, and it can be found at Life Without Plastic, which is a wonderful website that sells alternatives to plastic products that are made out of all different kinds of materials. So,
fantastic. All right, so I'm going to look that up, Life Without Plastic, and we'll talk about it again. On your website, you do have a thing to hit called Get Started Living Plastic Free. So give us the whole rundown. Give us a list of things that people can do in addition to going into restaurants and not using straws. All the basic stuff that we need to do to live plastic free.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't want to turn people off, but let me just preface all of this by saying every day is a challenge. I am not perfect. You do the best you can, and you've got to start somewhere. And I say that because, you know, we live on an ocean planet, and the health of the planet and the health of our water, we all need access to clean drinking water and the health of all of these different elements which allow life on this beautiful planet Earth that we live on to exist are dependent on us not damaging and not polluting this ecosystem, this environment, this biosphere that we live in. So I say all of that to you again, knowing that I am not perfect. But a great way to begin, and my way that I started, was to realize that I didn't need to take plastic bags anymore when I shop for food. So I've gotten in the habit of always bringing reusable canvas bags and baskets with me to the market, to the open farmer's market, to the health food market, to the drugstore. I keep some in the back of my car. I keep some on the doorknob on the back door. I keep some where I keep my bicycle. I just have them around. So I am always ready to go. And like I said, I like to keep a small fold-up one in my purse so that even if I suddenly jump out of the car and say, oh, my gosh, we need to buy milk, or there's something that we forgot to pick up that we've got to grab at the market, I never need to take a plastic bag. So that's an easy, I think, an easy place to begin. I think the next easy thing to do is as you're out in the world, whenever you order a drink, be it a lemonade, an iced tea, or a margarita, you say no straw when you order that drink. And you really make eye contact with, you know, the server or the waiter or the bartender and really impress upon them that that's something that's important to you. I think that the more people that do that, we will continue to help support and create change. Then, you know, another really big challenge for me is that we've gotten in the habit, particularly in the United States, we've become this big kind of coffee culture. You know, I personally am a big tea drinker, so I like to be able to get a hot beverage. If you do something routinely every day, for example, on your way to work, you're used to stopping at a Coffee Bean or a Pete's or a Starbucks and picking up a coffee, why not invest in a reusable steel or ceramic cup or mug that's got a lid that snaps down on it that you can use every day? And I think something that many people don't know, but you'll learn if you begin to do this, is that you actually get a small discount from these coffee shops if you bring your own cup. Obviously, it's preferable if you bring them a clean cup. So I would encourage you to clean it out and be sure that you're bringing them something clean. But that is a really nice thing to do, and it's a way to help you save money. I've noticed when I have to drive back and forth between Southern California and Northern California to the Bay Area, that I bring reusable cups with me in the car, and I bring a reusable, refillable stainless steel water bottle. That I fill up. I'll fill it up at home. I have filtered water at home. I drink tap water, LA's best, from a little filter that's right by my sink. I love it. I trust it more than I trust any bottled water, particularly based on the new reports that have come out from Orb Media, showing that there are microfibers not only in municipal drinking water, but also in the 25 top brands globally of bottled water. So my preference is to save money and drink filtered water. I refill my bottles. Now you'll notice at a lot of airports and points of travel, train stations, they're putting in hydration stations, which is kind of the newest iteration of drinking fountains. It's partially a drinking fountain, and then the back part of it allows you to refill a refillable bottle. And when I've forgotten my bottle or lost my steel bottle, I will do my best to buy a drink or something that's packaged in glass, and then I'll just reuse that glass bottle while I'm traveling. So those are all little things that you can do to get started. I mean, I can go on about this for a long time, Harvey, so just let me know.
I've got to say one thing that we're doing.
Yeah.
I've got grandchildren around the corner. I've got three of them. And I got to say that, you know, they have this ocean of toys, and they're all made with plastic, you know, and toys don't last long for kids. It's astounding. And we really have to have a different paradigm here, a different mindset of what we're going to use as our basic building block. And, you know, there's a whole bit of ocean of core work that needs to be done on the whole mindset of plastic. What's your take on that? I mean, how do we get off of a culture that's based on plastic onto something that is more practical?
Well, I think that this is connected to a much bigger picture issue, and we're watching a major trend happen with that, which is how do we decarbonize, like, the world? How do we move away? How do we divest from our dependence on fossil fuels? How do we move away from, you know, using petrochemicals for everything. And I don't know if most people know this, but for the most part, plastic is made from byproducts of processing petroleum. So how do we get off oil? And, you know, in our challenge and our setting our new goals to move towards a zero waste lifestyle, community, true sustainability, to move away from cradle to grave models into cradle to cradle models, you know, what does that really look like? And if we want to move away from this stuff, we have to begin to cultivate a consciousness about it. And part of that consciousness, I think, should be based also on some of the understanding that we're beginning to have from scientific studies that have been done. For example, the major study I just mentioned from Orb Media about microfibers and microplastics in drinking water and in bottled water. But this is really real. We're also seeing reports come back that they're finding microfibers and microplastics in shellfish, in clams and mussels and oysters and crabs and lobster. You know, we are also finding it in beer. We're finding it in salt. So I guess I don't want to be alarmist about this, but, you know, we need to wake up and look at the packaging that most of our food and our drinks are packaged in and think about how we can move away from these materials. You know, and it's difficult because plastic pollution is really an issue which disproportionately impacts people in lower income communities across the United States and around the globe. And that is because they are impacted in negative health ways all the way through the entire chain of production, from extraction and war and displacement, through production and manufacturing, through all of us using, eating, and drinking food out of these plastics with the chemicals that are used, these endocrine disrupting chemicals, which are the plasticizers, which are added to the carbon source in order to manufacture transparent, translucent plastic water bottles and plastic packaging for food. And then as soon as we've used it, it becomes an issue of waste management, an issue of taking up space in landfill, which is, you know, landfill is just the environment. And then how is that also coming back to us again through leaching of those chemicals, through getting into the ocean and the sea, through the breaking down of these plastics into microplastics, and then ingestion by the entire marine chain. And many people in the world depend on the ocean and wildlife from the ocean, sea life, for their primary source of protein. So it's coming back to us again. In a lot of different research which has been done, they've found that these plasticizing chemicals, which are added to the carbon source to make the plastic, so to the petroleum byproducts, include groups of chemicals called phthalates and bisphenols.
Can you spell that? Diana, can you spell that?
Bisphenol, B-I-S-P-H-E-N-O-L-S, bisphenol.
No, the plasticizing. The plasticizing.
Yeah, they're both plasticizing chemicals. Phthalates. P-T-H-L-A-T-E-S.
It's amazing.
So those chemicals have been identified as having as endocrine disruptors, which means that they impact our endocrine system. So they function a little bit like synthetic estrogen in our body, and we're dosing ourselves with micro amounts of these because it leaches out of the packaging for our food and beverage. And these chemicals have been linked in humans to lower sexual function, sterility, infertility, to breast cancer, brain cancer, and prostate cancer, and also to obesity and diabetes. And exposure to these chemicals in utero, so through the mother's body, through the umbilical cord to the baby in utero, have been linked to shortened anogenital distance, smaller penis size, feminization of boys, so boys getting breasts, early menses in girls getting their period when they're 5 or 6 or 7, and lower IQ. So this is really real, and it's all around us. And Dr. Frederick von Saal says that if you wanted to come up with the most diabolical experiment to produce with human beings, it would be bisphenol A and bisphenols. And Dr. Antonia Kalfat, who runs the endocrine disruption department at the Center for Disease Control, said that all of these products, which are now being advertised as BPA-free, so free of bisphenol A, that they're using BPB or BPC or BPS or BPZ, another bisphenol. And she said what they've been able to find so far is that these replacements for BPA are equally bad, if not worse, to BPA.
God. We're talking with Diana Cohen, the founder of the Plastics Pollution Coalition. And, I've been fighting nuclear power since 1973. And, you know, you get to with people who have been doing this for a long, long time, and you start to be in awe of the depth of their knowledge. And thank God that you've been on the case, Diana, because, plastics to me are completely diabolical. And it's almost as if somebody's running an experiment to see how fast we can wipe ourselves out. And the ubiquity, the omnipresence of this stuff is absolutely terrifying. For example, I just read, maybe you can tell me if this is credible or not, that because of the polyesters in our clothing that we put in the washing machine, the effluent, the throwaway water from the washing machines, which we never think about, is now also, saturated with these plastic-like particles that, are anti-life. And the other thing that really concerns me, and maybe you can speak to this, as you pointed out at the beginning, to paraphrase, you got inspired to do this work, seeing your plastic artwork disintegrate. It's not just the gyres, the massive visible plastic islands or continents that we're seeing in the ocean. It's the fact that the plastics break down into micro particles that now permeate the oceans. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it's a fair assessment, and they're also finding plastics in ice core samples from the Arctic. So, and then of course, what's going on as well is that industry likes to support this solution, and they've kind of it basically is incineration, but they've rebranded it as waste to energy. And of course, again, what that does is disproportionately affect lower income communities, because you're creating, when you burn this stuff, you're creating particulate pollution, and it's been connected to asthma and all different kinds of health issues for people who live in the nearby environment. So this stuff is kind of a mess. I mean, what I like to say, Harvey, and I don't know, Mimi, if you're still here, but is I like to say plastic is a valuable material, but when we design things for short use with intended obsolescence, we are using a valuable material in a totally irresponsible way. And so I recognize, the importance and the value and the not only the ubiquitousness, but the utilitarian functions of plastic. Plastic is quite remarkable. It's allowed us to lightweight all kinds of things and technology and airplanes and cars, et cetera. But when we design packaging, and really a lot of this is coming from the packaging industry and food packaging, when we design things with it, again, to be used for a very short amount of time under the guise of, that it keeps things clean or sanitary, what is the truth of that? If it is leaching chemicals into our food and beverages, is it really sanitary? If these chemicals potentially feed cancer, do we want people who are in the hospital to be eating and drinking all of their food out of plastic and styrofoam containers while they're lying there trying to get well? I mean, my answer would be no.
God, it's amazing. It really is amazing, because plastics just permeate in our society. You cannot, walk a foot without seeing something made of plastic in this country. So we only got 10 minutes left. Diana Cohen, you're a great guest and just full of incredible knowledge. And I have to have you back. I've been watching your stuff on YouTube and TED, and it's quite amazing. So what's the alternative?
We have a society that's permeated with plastic. I mean, I'm sitting in my backyard. I'm looking at my grandchildren's toys. They're all plastic. How do we change in the nuclear business and in fighting nuclear power? We have successfully been able to substitute wind and solar. Now we haven't won the battle, but we're certainly winning the war, and it's coming in cheaper. And what I've found over the decades is ultimately what's good for the planet is good for the economy. So somewhere out there, there must be a natural based substitute for plastic, where we can switch this whole paradigm of petroleum based tchotchkes filling our lives with something, some other kind of base. I will guarantee you that in 10 years, the vast bulk of our energy will be generated with renewables. So what is the equivalent of renewables in plastics?
Well, I would say the equivalent is, and this is a question that I asked myself in 2009 when we were creating the coalition. The question is, you know, we didn't always use plastic. It's relatively new. It's only been invented in the last century. And, you know, what did we use before and what do we have available to us right now while we're waiting for new things to be discovered that could be used in place of plastic? And I think that comes down to using paper, using glass, using metal, using wood, using bamboo, using coconut. You know, there's lots of other things around us. And we also, I think, can look to more traditional materials, ceramics, things that people have used for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And frankly, I found it because at some point I had to say goodbye to some Tupperware that I really loved because I realized it probably wasn't good for me. I looked at one of my Tupperware containers and realized that if it was gathering and absorbing the color from some acid spaghetti sauce that was in it, was it actually exchanging molecules with the plastic? And I thought, you know, it probably is. And so I decided to switch to storing my food in glass and food grade stainless steel. And it's been a process. Some of the things I store my food in at home include Pyrex containers that were manufactured in the 60s and 70s. And sometimes I find them online or at secondhand stores or the Goodwill. But I'm also seeing, even at chain stores like Bed Bath, Bath & Beyond or Costco, people are now selling whole sets of glass containers that you can use to store food in. Or, you know, it was very common in the 50s and 60s to have dishes and things that could go from the refrigerator to the oven and the oven to the refrigerator, et cetera. So I think we need to just look back at that. And it doesn't mean that we need to purchase things, but we need to replace them. So I try to buy things packaged in glass or packaged without packaging. You know, fruit and vegetables, when you go to the market, why do they all need to be in individual plastic bags or wrapped or you know, shrink-wrapped in plastic? They don't need to be. It's a miracle thing, but, you know, most fruits and vegetables, they grow with their own skin and their own packaging, and you can just pick them up and put them in your bag or your basket and pay for them and bring them home. And in the refrigerator, the same thing. I keep them that way. I just put them in the drawer. And, you know, this, I'm looking at a cabbage right now. My cabbage doesn't seem to mind. It's okay. The carrot yeah. doesn't mind, you know? And it was a joy and a pleasure for me to go buy them at the Hollywood Farmers Market and see all that beautiful color and buy things that are seasonal, you know? So, I don't know if that really answers your question. I mean, there's a lot going on in terms of technology as well and people trying to come up with new kinds of replacements for plastic that we'll be packaging. And they're looking at everything from making it out of seaweed or algae to making it out of shrimp skin, you know, or different kinds of plants. But of course, it involves, we have to look at what kind of plasticizers are being added to that and to see if that's healthy for us.
Well, this is a critical.
You know, Harvey, with your kids, with your grandkids, maybe you want to move some of their toys away from all being plastic. You know,
oh, absolutely.
It's not that good for them, especially the mushy, soft ones are heavily phthalated, and it's not good for kids.
We're talking with Diana Kahn. Diana, we're almost out of time. You're a spectacular guest. Well, how do we get a hold of you real quick?
Was there an
you can find me at PlasticSolutionCoalition.org.
Diana, you're fantastic. I'll have to have you back. You're really amazing. This has been the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. We'll be back next week.
Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground.